Well, it is time for us to wish our listeners that are celebrating a happy birthday today on this January 31st. We have four we're aware of: Sheila Benton from Fort Dodge, Maxine Hansen from Zeering, Edna Haneke from Montrose, and Linda Pentico from Vinton. All of us here at IBRIS would like to wish the four of you a very happy birthday. And a reminder, you're listening to IBRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service. If you're hearing us on your television on Iowa PBS and you're not a registered IBRIS user, please give us a call at 515-243-6833 so we can get you on our list. We need to know who is listening in order to keep our services free. And now here's Barb with today's obituaries.
Thank you, Dennis. Verona L. Johnson escaped a 10-year unwinnable battle and war with Alzheimer's dementia with her passing on January 28th. She refused to allow this tragic disease to define her or her life during that journey. Verona was born February 13, 1943, to parents Kenneth and Marjorie Evans in Ames and grew up in rural Ellsworth. She thrived academically, musically, and athletically in her educational and social formation in that community. She was a valedictorian of her graduating high school class of 1961 and was a forward on the girls' basketball team that went to the state tournament in 1961 during the years of 6-6 girls' basketball. She was an enthusiastic piano player and participant in vocal music. She attended AIB, the American Institute of Business, in Des Moines after high school and earned an associate degree in business. She leveraged that degree with engineering extension at Iowa State University for 5 years as an administrative assistant to the department head. Verona and her high school sweetheart, Marv Johnson, were married June 8, 1963. Verona and Marv always worked at a team and both held multiple jobs during the 7 years that Mary pursued her dream of studying to become a veterinarian. They achieved that dream with his graduation with his DVM in May of 1968. Verona and Marv then moved to South Bend, Indiana, where he practiced veterinary medicine for 10 years, and they completed their family with 3 children. Verona and her family moved back to Iowa in 1987, where spouse Marv practiced veterinary medicine for 48 years in his multiple practices. Verona, always a part of the Johnson family team, supported the practices as financial manager. During the 47 years that Verona and her family lived in Iowa, in the cities of Urbandale and West Des Moines, she acquired many friends who made her life whole and enjoyable, and she participated in Faith Lutheran Church activities and activities associated with the profession of veterinary medicine locally and nationally, including many trips to Hawaii to attend meetings. For all those people and for all the committed and loving friends who supported Verona in her long and sad medical journey, the family says thank you for being there for her and for them. Visitation will take place from 5 to 7 p.m. on Thursday, February 1st, at Hamilton's on Westtown Parkway in West Des Moines. Funeral services will be at 10 a.m. Friday, February 2nd, at Faith Lutheran Church, 10395 University Avenue in Clive, with burial at Homewood Cemetery in Ellsworth. Verona's family would like to thank the staff at Suncrest Hospice and the Iowa Jewish Senior Life Center for their attentiveness, compassion, and competence in supporting and caring for Verona in the very difficult time for Verona and her grateful family. Memorials may be directed to Faith Lutheran Church Memorial Fund or the Alzheimer's Association. Condolences may be expressed at hamiltonsfuneralhome.com. Dixie L. Jeffries, 80, of Des Moines, died unexpectedly in her sleep on January 24th. Per her wishes, she was cremated, and a graveside service will be held at Highland Memory Garden Cemetery at 10 a.m. on Friday, May 8th, when hopefully the weather will allow her friends to gather and share stories. Dixie, born July 20, 1943, was a loving daughter of John and Dorothy Jeffries. She graduated in June 1961 from Lincoln High School in Des Moines and remained a proud alum throughout her life, enjoyed helping plan class reunions and class lunches. Dixie worked for 11 years for the manager of the Fleming Building and retired in December 2010 after 38 years as a legal secretary at the law firm of Ehlers & Cooney, P.C. After retirement, Dixie traveled worldwide, visiting 27 countries and 47 states, and enjoyed photography. Dixie spent her time caring for and sharing meals and laughter with her many friends. In lieu of flowers, memorial contributions may be made to the Abraham Lincoln High School Alumni Foundation as administrator of Dixie L. Jeffries Memorial Scholarship. Donations may be made online to alhsalumni.com/named-scholarship or mailed to ALHS Alumni Foundation, P.O. Box 36624, Des Moines 50315. Jacob, known as Jake Clarence Anderson, 36, of Lincoln, died Friday, January 26th in West Des Moines. Born on November 18, 1987, to Jeffrey and Allison Anderson, he was married to Kaylee Casper on December 31, 2018. Jake graduated from the University of Nebraska in Lincoln, earning a bachelor's degree in meteorology and climatology with a minor in mathematics and a master's degree in earth and atmospheric science prior to joining the United States Air Force as a pilot in 2015. He most recently served as a major in the Iowa Air National Guard as a remote pilot and instructor and was pursuing a master's degree in military operational and science. Military operational art and science. Among his military colleagues, he was best known as Mr. The family invites family, friends, and loved ones to celebrate Jake's life Saturday, February 3rd at 10 a.m. at Roper & Sons South Lincoln Chapel, 3950 Hohensee Drive in Lincoln, Nebraska. A visitation will be held prior at the same location on Friday, February 2nd from 2 to 6 p.m. A live stream option will be offered for the funeral services and can be accessed via the Roper & Sons website. That's roperandsons.com. Memorials may be given to the family for the education of Jake's sons, Brooks, who's 3 years old, and Miles, 6 months. Memorials may be shared directly to the family or via everloved.com/life-of/Jacob-Anderson. Additionally, an email address has been created for loved ones to share stories, memories, photos, videos, etc., to further carry the memory of Jake to his wife, sons, and family. Please share to jake.anderson1118@gmail.com. Margaret Joan, known as Annie Viola, 89, passed away peacefully on January 24th at Ramsey Village Care Facility. The family will greet guests from 10 to 11 a.m. on Thursday, February 1st at Hamilton's near Highland Memory Gardens in Des Moines. A funeral service will follow at 11 a.m. at the funeral home. Burial will take place at Glendale Cemetery in Des Moines. To view Margaret's full obituary or place an online condolence, please visit hamiltonsfuneralhome.com. Funeral Mass for Judy Lou Pearson, 80, of Omaha, Nebraska, who passed away Sunday, January 28th, will be held at 11 a.m. Tuesday, February 6th, at St. Thomas Aquinas Catholic Church in Indianola. Burial will follow at the Calvary Cemetery in Churchville, Iowa. Visitation will be held from 5 to 7 p.m. Monday, February 5th, at Overton Funeral Home in Indianola. Reciting of the Rosary will be held at 5 p.m. prior to visitation. Many thanks to St. Joseph Villa staff and St. Joseph Home Care and Hospice staff for the care and attention given by them, especially Anna, Dave, and Maria. Memorials may be given in Judy's name to St. Thomas Aquinas Catholic Church or St. Joseph Home Care and Hospice, 825 Dorcas Street in Omaha, Nebraska, 68108. To sign an online condolence, visit the website of OvertonFuneralHomes.com. Irene Wigner Tower, age 101, of Des Moines, passed away on January 26th. Irene was born in New York, New York, and spent her formative years in Freeport, Maine, in Bergen County, New Jersey, before settling in Newburgh, New York, where she lived most of her adult life. In her mid-80s, she moved to Des Moines, Iowa, where she enthusiastically embraced her new community. A funeral will be held Friday, February 2nd at 10 a.m. at St. Paul's Episcopal Cathedral. In lieu of flowers, donations may be made to St. Cory Hospice or the Iowa Food Pantry. Christina L. Simpson, 70, passed away January 28th at the Good Samaritan Society in Forest City, Iowa. Her funeral will begin at 2 p.m. Saturday, February 3rd, at Isles Westover Chapel, where her family will greet friends beginning at 1 p.m. Christina, the daughter of Gerald and Frances Coles, was born November 20, 1953, in Des Moines. She received training from Mercy and DMAC and worked as a registered nurse. Condolences can be expressed at islescares.com. And Jill Clark of West Des Moines, 77, passed away peacefully on January 20th at her home in West Des Moines. Please go to islesfuneralhome.com for more information.
That concludes today's obituaries. Thank you, Barb. Moving on now to some national news. Alaska set to break snowfall records. Anchorage has already notched over 100 inches. Alaska is on track to break snowfall records after Anchorage has recorded more than 100 inches, the earliest accumulation ever of that amount, collapsing roofs and closing schools. The city, which was hit with almost 16 inches of snow over the weekend, has now had over 8.5 feet this winter, marking the second year to break the 100-inch mark. If the trend continues, Anchorage could break its all-time record of 134.5 inches recorded in the winter of 2011. "We're at the most snow for the season today," said Brian Brutschneider, an Alaska-based climate scientist for the National Weather Service. "We were up to 104.3 inches, and we'd never hit this amount before the end of January before." "Snow on the ground already reached a depth of 37 inches, Brutschneider said. "Even if we have the least amount of snow that we've ever had from this point for the rest of the winter, that would still leave us in the top five snowiest winters," he said. The stunning levels of precipitation have been a challenge for the snow-hardened city, leading to the collapse of three buildings already this year, and city officials warned of the persistent danger of heavy snow piling onto roofs, estimating in a snow removal notice posted last week that 500 to 1,000 city buildings have roof trusses of immediate concern. The snow's weight reached more than 30 pounds per square foot, meaning a 1,500 square foot roof would be supporting the weight of 8 full-size light-duty pickup trucks, according to the notice. Brett Schneider said the snow on the roof of the Weather Service office had already reached 36.5 pounds, just 3.5 pounds under local building code requirements. "Certainly, we've had isolated problems with roof collapses," he said. Many Anchorage residents worked to clear off the potentially dangerous roof snow. Henry Lucas volunteered to help his elderly neighbors. "They have a really wide house," Lucas told USA Today. "It doesn't have very much pitch to the roof." Lucas, a 33-year-old construction worker, would rather wait for help to clear his own roof. "I need to have someone here with me. I don't want to do it by myself just because it's high up," he said. In response to the weather conditions, Anchorage schools kept children home Monday for a remote learning day. The city was also chilled to double-digit below-zero temperatures, and forecast calls for minus 21 degrees at night later this week. Anchorage Mayor Dave Bronson declared a public health and safety emergency that will remain in effect until at least February 9th because of the frigid weather. The low temperatures show no signs of stopping, with temperatures that are significantly 20, 30, 40 degrees below normal, which are forecast through next week. In the midst of the hefty snowfall, other parts of the state saw record high temperatures. Sitka Airport recorded a new record of 54 degrees on Sunday, and Ketchikan Airport tied a past record of 55 degrees the same day, according to the National Weather Service. Juneau Airport also reached a record high of 46 degrees days after the capital city was hit with a winter storm warning that saw snow pile up to more than 5 feet. The snow caused route changes to the Juneau bus system and closed down in-person operations of city buildings on Wednesday. The combination of heavy snow levels, the record high temperatures, threatened to trigger landslides and avalanches in the area. City officials warned residents to avoid avalanche paths on Wednesday after two avalanches blocked a local intersection. A crew of Juneau firefighters rescued a person Saturday who was pinned to the side of his house after a nearby creek that was dammed up by the snow suddenly released, triggering a landslide. However, even with record-setting highs, Sunday and Monday were the coldest days statewide in 4 years, if you average for the entire state, Brent Schneider said. The accumulation of ice in Juneau's harbors also caused at least four boats to sink as harbor officials pleaded with residents to check their vessels. Salvage operations, or salvage efforts, for the sunken boats were underway on Friday, officials reported on Facebook. Avalanche debris caused authorities on Monday to shut down Haines Highway, which runs from the town of Haines on the southeastern peninsula to the U.S.-Canadian border. Severe weather also forced the closure of Thompson Pass, a scenic pass through a 2,600-high gap in the Chagache Mountains, around 270 miles east of Anchorage. Still, the chill didn't stop many Alaskans from enjoying the snow. In Anchorage, it paved the way for the rebirth of Snowzilla, a 20-foot snowman that residents have brought back to life every year for a decade. The snowfall brought winter sports right to Lucas's own backyard in the form of snow-packed hill for sledding. It's probably 12 or 13 feet tall, he said. For longtime Anchorage residents, such as Lucas, a heavy snowfall can be cause for celebration. I think it depends on how long you've been here and probably your age, if you have a lot of shoveling to do, he said. But for most people, you live here because you enjoy the outdoors, the cold, the snow, the elements, he added. I love the snow.
Musk says the first Neuralink recipient is recovering well. The first human to receive a Neuralink cybernetic implant is recovering well, tech billionaire Elon Musk announced Monday. Quote, initial results show promising neuron spike detection, Musk said on X, formerly Twitter, after the Sunday procedure. Neuralink's brain-computer interface, or BCI, would allow people to control a computer or mobile device wirelessly just by thinking about it, according to the company's website. Musk said the project is called telepathy. The goal of the new technology is to allow paralyzed individuals the ability to control a computer cursor or keyboard using just their thoughts. In May 2023, the tech startup, owned and co-founded by Musk, announced it received approval from the Food and Drug Administration to implant brain chips into humans. The company announced in September that it received approval to recruit for the first in-human clinical trial of its wireless BCI. Quote, imagine if Stephen Hawking could communicate faster than a speed typist or auctioneer. That is a goal, Musk said in a post on X. The study uses a robot to surgically place the implant into a region of the brain that controls movement intention. After the N1 implant is surgically placed, it's supposed to record and transmit brain signals wirelessly to an app that decodes movement intention. The surgical robot was created specifically to embed the implant and its 64 ultra-thin flexible connected threads, upon which 1,024 electrodes that record neural activity. The robot has 5 built-in camera systems and uses optical coherence tomography for non-invasive imaging of brain tissue. The robot uses a needle as thin as a human hair, Neuralink site says. Neuralink's goal with its human trials is to eventually enable people with paralysis to use a computer or phone with their brain activity alone. The N1 implant actually includes multiple chips, a wireless battery, and other electronics hermetically sealed within a device about the size of a large coin. Several dozen ultra-thin threads protrude from the implant. Those go directly into the brain. Signals from the implant are sent via Bluetooth to and decoded by a brain-computer interface, which would allow a person to, for instance, control an on-screen cursor or move a robotic limb. Quote, the first thing that we're going after is a wireless implanted chip that would enable someone who is a tetraplegic or quadriplegic to control a computer or mouse or their phone or really any device just by thinking. This obviously would be a massive enabler, make life way easier for them. I say it's like a Fitbit in your skull with tiny wires that go to your brain, Musk said in an online chat on 2021. Beyond helping paralyzed patients regain some mobility and communicate without typing, Neuralink's longer-term goals include helping restore full mobility and sight.
Weapons hit list lead to 130 charges for New York City men. Two brothers were indicted Monday after a raid on their New York City apartment yielded an arsenal of untraceable firearms, homemade bombs, and a hit list with cops, judges, politicians, celebrities, and, quote, banker scum, scrawled on it, authorities said. Andrew Hatzeligis, 39, and Angelo Hatzeligis, 51, face 130 criminal counts related to their collection of weapons and explosives, the Queens District Attorney's Office said in a news release. Detectives began investigating the siblings after it picked up intelligence regarding the purchase of parts and accessories for ghost guns, untraceable weapons often sold in kits and assembled privately. Angelo Hatzeligis pleaded not guilty to all 130 charges, according to the New York State Court System website. It's unclear whether Andrew had his first appearance. On January 17th, New York City police raided the brothers' apartment in the Queens Borough, which they share with their mother and another brother. When members of the New York Police Department bomb squad discovered the explosives, they evacuated the entire building. The New York Police Department seized dozens of weapons and tactical gear, including 8 explosive devices, 2 AR-15-style ghost guns, body armor, and more than 600 rounds of ammunition and smoke bombs. The city is safer today, Queens District Attorney Melinda Katz said in a statement. We cannot measure the number of lives that were saved, but we do know that these weapons will never hurt anyone. The brothers' next court date is scheduled for February 15th. If convicted, they face up to 25 years in prison, according to the district attorney. Ghost guns are often assembled from kits purchased online or 3D printed and do not have serial numbers, making them untraceable. They also allow the buyer to evade background checks. Many of the weapons recovered from the brothers' apartment included 2 semi-automatic pistols, which were assembled with parts made by a 3D printer, according to the district attorney. Along with the guns, ammunition, and hit list, the brothers owned a 3D printer that was seized by police. The Queens District Attorney's Office has successfully led a citywide crackdown on ghost gun manufacturers and traffickers. Since 2021, Queens has recovered more ghost guns than any other New York City borough. A report published last year by the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives showed a surge in the number of ghost guns recovered throughout the nation, as well as an increase in the weapons being used in crimes. The number of suspected ghost guns recovered by law enforcement and submitted to the Bureau for tracing increased by more than 1,000% from 2017 to 21, the report said. In 2022, President Joe Biden introduced rules aiming at ghost guns by qualifying them under the Gun Control Act, which requires manufacturers to become federally licensed and run background checks before sale. The rules also requires gun parts to have serial numbers. In October, the Supreme Court ordered 2 sellers of ghost gun parts to comply with Biden's regulation after a federal judge previously sided with the companies.
Justice Department announces alleged murder-for-hire plot. An Iranian and 2 Canadian nationals were indicted over an alleged plot to murder an Iranian defector and another Maryland resident on U.S. soil, the Justice Department announced Monday. The 3 alleged conspirators were part of a criminal network targeting Iranian dissidents at Tehran's direction, according to the department. One defendant, Damian Patrick John Ryan, is a full-patch member of the Hells Angel Motorcycle Club, the department said. The plot unfolded from about December 2020 to March 2021, according to an indictment filed in Minnesota federal court. Iranian resident Naji Sharifi Zindashti allegedly tasked Ryan with assembling an assassination team to go to Maryland to murder 2 victims, who authorities didn't name. The targeted victims, a man and woman, fled to the U.S. after one of them defected from Iran, the government said. The announcement comes about a year after the government charged 3 members of an Eastern European criminal gang in a murder-for-hire plot targeting New York-based journalist and activist Mahsi Alijinan. There, too, the government alleged the plot was linked to the Iranian government. Ryan solicited another Canadian national who was illegally residing in Minnesota, Adam Richard Pearson, and the pair discussed shooting one of the targets in the head enough to erase his head from his torso. in quotes, in order to make an example of him, according to the December 3rd indictment, which was announced Monday. The government said Ryan and Pearson are both currently incarcerated in Canada for unrelated offenses. The three conspirators agreed on a $350,000 payment for the murders, which they said would be executed by a multi-person team, plus $20,000 more for travel costs, according to the indictment. In a statement included in Monday's announcement, Assistant Attorney General Matthew G. Olson warned, quote, those in Iran who plot murders on U.S. soil, that the department will pursue you as long as it takes and wherever you are, and deliver justice. Each defendant was charged with conspiring to use an interstate commerce facility, specifically an encrypted messaging service, to commit a murder for hire. Pearson also faces illegal gun possession charges. Contact information for the three defendants wasn't immediately available.
Election Board says Trump can stay on Illinois ballot. Decision likely to result in appeal in state court. Former President Donald Trump can run in Illinois' presidential primary, the state's election board ruled in unanimous decision on Tuesday. The move came a week before the U.S. Supreme Court will consider whether an anti-insurrectionist safeguard in the Constitution can be used to disqualify Trump. The former president has already been barred from ballots in Colorado and Maine over his role in the January 6, 2021 attack on the U.S. Capitol, though he's fighting the decisions. The Illinois board that found Trump can run in the state's 2024 primary is composed of four Democrats and four Republicans. The decision came after a former Republican judge who had been appointed to hear arguments in the case found that Trump is ineligible based on a preponderance of the evidence. But the judge also recommended that the board leave the decision in the hands of the courts. Trump has asked the Supreme Court to overturn the Colorado Supreme Court's ruling that he is disqualified from the state's primary ballot. Their case hinges on a section of the 14th Amendment, enacted after the Civil War, to bar from office those who had engaged in insurrection after previously promising to support the Constitution. Trump argues the amendment does not apply to former presidents, and even if it does, he did not engage in insurrection. Trump never told his supporters to enter the Capitol ahead of the January 6 riot, and he did not lead, direct, or encourage any of the unlawful acts that occurred at the Capitol, his lawyers have told the Supreme Court. In addition to Colorado and Maine, Trump's eligibility has been challenged across the country. Some state courts and officials looked at the idea and passed, including California, Minnesota, and Michigan. Colorado Supreme Court and the Secretary of State in Maine concluded Trump's actions barred him from their ballots. Those decisions have been put on hold until the Supreme Court weighs in. Well, it's time for us to move on here. For the last 90 minutes, your readers have been Barbara Heck and Dennis May, and it's been our pleasure to read for you. And now we're going to take a short break to allow our next readers to get into place.
welcome back. Your new readers are Patty Daniels, that's me, and Pam Rhodes. We'll continue with articles from the Des Moines Register and USA Today. Here's Pam with our next article.
Bidenomics versus Trump, doom and gloom. This article is written by Chris Brennan of the USA Today staff. Listen to the men who are, one, president of the United States, or two, trying to get that job again, and you might think that this country has at least two very different economies. President Joe Biden is trying to win a second term this year by selling an economic rebound with data to back it all up, but American voters sure seem slow to buy that. Former President Donald Trump paints a picture of looming economic collapse with his standard, quote, only I can fix it, end quote, messaging. He went so far this month to openly wish for an economic crash in the country this year. Everyone else is giving off wait-and-see vibes. That's bad news for both Biden and Trump. Ask economists and people who understand political messaging. They'll tell you, like they told me, that the president needs voters to feel much better right now about their economic outlook, and the former president needs people to fear that it's all teetering on the edge of a cliff. The truth, as always, is somewhere in the middle. The economy is improving, but it's not all the way back. Inflation is slowing, but things still cost more than they used to. The numbers look good, but numbers don't always go in the direction you want. Larry Sabato, director of University of Virginia Center for Politics, told me the economy is usually a lagging indicator for voters showing confidence that we're in an upswing. It takes people a while to believe good news in particular, Sabato said. Fortunately for President Biden, the economy is clearly turning around at the right time for November. While Trump's base won't stray with the news, Sabato added, Biden's second term hinges on him motivating his own voters and winning the small number of true independents. Here's what the math shows us about the United States now. America's economy grew at a rate of 3.3% in the last 3 months of 2023 and by 2.5% overall for the year. Ironically, Trump spent most of his long term as president bragging about similar numbers. The Democratic National Committee on Thursday brought receipts offering links to 6 times that Trump took credit for economic growth in 2017 and 2018. In one, Trump said during a July 2017 cabinet meeting that a 2.6 quarterly growth rate that had just been announced is, quote, is an unbelievable number, end quote. 2 months later, he told reporters flying with him on Air Force One that everybody was shocked to see a newly announced quarterly rate of 3%. Trump is singing a different song these days. Campaigning in New Hampshire on January 22nd, he called Biden a disaster on the economy. Even Trump, in that speech, had to slip in a caveat, except for the stock market. He was speaking just days after the S&P 500 hit a record high. Biden had some fun with that, posting video on the website previously known as Twitter of Trump claiming before the 2020 election that the country would see, quote, a stock market collapse the likes of which you've never had, end quote. If Biden won, it was coupled with a clip from Fox News touting the recent good news about the stock market. Good one, Donald, the current president trolled his predecessor on January 22nd. Trump has good reason to hope for a bad economy. Any win for Biden makes Trump's bid for the White House less likely to succeed. That's why Trump is trying to kill bipartisan negotiations in the Senate on legislation to improve border security and reform immigration. That would ease another line of attack for the ex-president. Trump is playing to consumer fear while Biden courts them with hope. Fear has always been an easier sell. We just spent 2023 listening to endless punditry about an allegedly looming recession. And while those warnings are on the wane, they clearly left some lingering doubt, particularly among partisan lines. A Suffolk University USA Today poll this month showed signs of optimism, but it also found that Republicans were far more likely than Democrats to assume the country is in a recession rather than in recovery. Joanne Sue, director of University of Michigan Surveys of Consumers, said consumer confidence has been relatively slow to rebound in the past year, despite the evidence of an improving economy. But then it jumped by nearly 30% as 2023 became 2024. That's really unusual, Sue said. The last time we saw an increase of that magnitude was in 1991, when we were coming out of a recession. This confidence, she added, is reflected among Democrats, Republicans, and Independents. Even so, she cautions, it's still trending at about 7% lower than historical average compiled since 1978. James Pethakoukas, who analyzes economic policy as a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, said inflation is the entire story about consumer confidence because we all just lived through a spike in increased cost unlike anything seen in the past 40 years. That sticks with people more and longer than other economic news, unemployment, job layoffs, interest rates, and so on. Inflation, that affects everyone, he said. It is a far more pervasive phenomenon, so it was an economic shock. And with inflation, prices are more likely to stop going up than they are to come down. Pethakoukas said this summer will be critical for the economy, consumer sentiment, and the presidential election. People have short memories, Pethakoukas said. They're going to care a lot more about what happens in the economy in 6 months before they go to the polls in 2024 than what happened in 2021 or 2022. Expect to hear plenty from Biden between now and November about things looking up. He'll be touting statistics just like Trump back in 2017 and 2018. And Trump will spout pessimism nonstop, since a bad economy is good for him. The former president already has shown a willingness to lie about the data and distort economic conditions because that's what he needs to win. The better things get, the more we'll hear about how terrible it all is.
Thank you, Pam. Gerwig was snubbed but didn't snub mothers. Written for us by Carolyn Bolton. Greta Gerwig, who directed Barbie, deserves more from the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences than exhaustion from its exclusion from its list of Best Director nominees. While Oscar voters didn't consider Gerwig's work good enough for a nomination, her delicate rendering of the female experience is more than enough for appreciative fans. One idea in particular that Gerwig gently weaves into the movie is the notion that women are made for more than professional success, namely motherhood. But achieving that level of self-actualization in the modern American workplace and society at large isn't without obstacles. Gerwig brilliantly captures this part of the female struggle when Will Ferrell's character, the CEO of doll manufacturer Mattel, travels to Barbie land and cringes when crossing paths with Midge, a pregnant Barbie so controversial in real life that she was temporarily pulled from store shelves. Barbie land, implies Gerwig, isn't all rainbows and butterflies. Instead, Barbie land falls short of the ideal for those women who want to lean into their biology, for the women who want it all instead of foregoing children and girl-bossing their way from cubicle to corner office. Sadly, the same is true of the real world. Take, for example, the recent kite baby fiasco in which the CEO of a baby products company denied a mother's request to work from home to care for her newly adopted premature baby who was fighting for his life in a neonatal intensive care unit. The lesson from all this? Our society has a long way to go in accepting women for their intelligence and their biology. Instead of discouraging pregnancy through an overemphasis on reproductive rights and rigid work rules, lawmakers should protect would-be moms. Vice President Kamala Harris' recent comment citing parents' concern that college-age women lack abortion rights, however, impedes progress on the front. Our leaders should instead champion policies that empower women to balance work and motherhood. Instead of reflexively pointing pregnant women to abortion facilities, for example, lawmakers should address the hurdles that discourage pregnancy and otherwise make it difficult for women to carry their babies to term. That can be achieved in a number of ways. A good place to start is abortion advocates' own research. The Guttmacher Institute reports that three of the most common reasons women seek abortions are fear they can't afford a baby, fear a baby would interfere with school or work, and fear of raising a baby alone. To allay these fears, lawmakers could roll out private-public partnerships to expand maternity leave programs, increase the availability of their flexible spending accounts to pay for child care, and, through tax incentives, encourage work-from-home arrangements, which now are shrinking post-pandemic. Ultimately, in a world where women are having fewer kids than they desire and are having those kids later in life, it's critical that lawmakers take these recommendations to heart. Only then can women build their own version of Barbie Land before age and disease eclipse their hopes for the future. What's more, for all the self-actualization talk and the be what you want to be, mumbo jumbo, perhaps the most disenfranchising title a woman can earn in 21st century America is mom. That needs to change, and Gerwig deserves more than an Oscar for advancing that conversation. Now, Carolyn Bolton is the communications and marketing director for Donors Trust, a mission folk. She lives in Alexandria, Virginia.
Turning now to the sports schedule, these are the sports on television today, Wednesday, January 31, and all these times are Eastern Time Zone. AHL Hockey, 7 p.m., NHLN, Hershey at Lehigh Valley. College Basketball Men's, 6:30 p.m., BTN, Northwestern at Purdue. FS1, St. John's at Xavier. SECN, Alabama at Georgia. 7 p.m. ACCN, Wake Forest at Pittsburgh. ESPNU, Wichita State at Tulsa. ESPN2, Notre Dame at Virginia. 8 p.m. CBSSN, Northern Iowa at Bradley. ESPN, Florida at Kentucky. 8:30 p.m. BTN, Penn State at Rutgers. FS1, Providence at University of Connecticut. SECN, Arkansas at Missouri. 9 p.m. ESPNU, UAB at North Texas. ESPN2, Vanderbilt at Auburn. 10:30 p.m. FS1, Boise State at New Mexico. 11 p.m. ESPNU, Santa Clara at St. Mary's in California. College Basketball Women's, 7 p.m., Peacock, Indiana at Maryland. 8 p.m., Peacock, Iowa at Northwestern. Golf, 2 a.m., Thursday. Golf, Women's Amateur, the Asian Pacific Championship, first round, Siam County Club, Payetta, Thailand. NBA basketball, 8:30 p.m. ABC, Phoenix at Brooklyn, 10 p.m. ESPN, Milwaukee at Portland. NFL football, 10:30 a.m. ESPNU, Senior Bowl, Practice, Mobile, Alabama. NFLN, Senior Bowl, Practice, Mobile, Alabama, 1 p.m. ESPN2, Senior Bowl, Practice, Mobile, Alabama. NFLN, Senior Bowl, Practice, Mobile, Alabama. NHL Hockey, 7:30 p.m., TNT and Max, Los Angeles at Nashville. Soccer, Men's, 2:30 p.m., USA, Premier League, Brentford at Tottenham Hotspur. Tennis, 6 a.m., Tennis, Hua Hin WTA, Montpellier, ATP, Early Rounds, 1, Tennis, Montpellier, ATP, Early Rounds, 2 a.m., Thursday, Tennis, Hua Hin WTA, Montpellier, ATP, Early Rounds.
ESPN's Crame on what is that? I don't know how to pronounce that name. Crame, C-R-E-M-E, on what ISU must do for NCAA bid. This is college women's basketball. ESPN college women's basketball bracketologist Charlie Crame didn't think Iowa State's young roster would be ready to compete for a trip to the NCAA tournament this season. The Cyclones had lost key players from last season's roster and were planning to lean on a group of freshmen to replace them. I foresaw this as a true rebuilding year, and we'll talk to you in 2025 about the tournament, Crame said. The Cyclones, despite a recent skid, have been one of the surprise stories of the women's basketball season. They're in good position to get back to the NCAA tournament if they take care of business. In the second half of the Big 12 season starting Wednesday, when Iowa State hosts Oklahoma State at 6:30 p.m. at Hilton Coliseum. It's happened a lot faster than I thought, Crame said. Many expected 2023-24 would be about building the foundation for upcoming seasons. After five players entered the transfer portal and star Ashley Jones finished her eligibility and headed to the WNBA. The Cyclones also lost post player Stephanie Suarez, whose medical waiver request was denied by the NCAA. Iowa State coach Bill Fennelly filled out the roster with fresh faces, including the highly decorated freshman class. The group included five high school stars, Ariana Jackson, Addie Brown, Audie Crooks, Jalen Bristow, and Kelsey Jones. All five have started games and are playing a lot of minutes. Transfers Hannah Bellinger and Isnell Natabon have also been key contributors. While the roles of the five freshmen were expected to be significant, the success they've had wasn't predicted by many. The Cyclones enter Wednesday's game against Oklahoma State with a 12-7 overall mark and are tied for fourth place in the conference with a 6-3 record. They boast an impressive resume that includes a signature with a win over number 7 Baylor and a nice victory over West Virginia, a team that has been in the rankings this season. Iowa State began 5-0 in Big 12 and suddenly started appearing in Crame's projections, something he never envisioned happening in this season. I saw the talent that walked out the door, and I just said, it's too soon, Crame said. I know there were reasonably high expectations around the new people being brought in and the youngsters, but they're exactly that. Iowa State has gone from one of Crame's last four to one of the last four with a bye in Crame's NCAA tournament projections. But the season is far from over, and there are still plenty of unanswered questions. There are inevitably other upsets coming, and likely some bid stealers with automatic qualifiers coming with conference tournament crowns. Crame said, Iowa State can do plenty to help its cause during the second half of the conference season. The remaining Big 12 state offers opportunities to spruce up the resume and potentially lock in a bid with two matchups against Kansas State and one at Texas. The Cyclones also host Oklahoma, another team that's trying to push its way into the tournament, according to Crame. Even if Iowa State misses out on those opportunities, the Cyclones still could get an invite by avoiding any major miscues. That means beating teams in the lower half of the league and protecting home court against Oklahoma State on Wednesday. Because the game's at home, there has to be an expectation of a win, Crame said. If the game was on the road, you'd still hope they would win, but it wouldn't be detrimental. A win over K-State, Texas, or Oklahoma would help give Iowa State some breathing room. The best thing Iowa State can do right now, start a new winning streak. The current skid consists of three road losses versus Texas Tech, Kansas, and West Virginia. ISU had a shot in all three games, losing by a combined 16 points. Mixed in was a home victory versus TCU that wasn't contested. The Horned Frogs had to forfeit due to a lack of available players. A Cyclones victory in their return home to Hilton Coliseum is an important step toward avoiding any unexpected setbacks. The thing that you want to base something simply on, the committee is sitting there. Do they think that this team can compete in the NCAA tournament? How can they compete against NCAA tournament-level teams? Crame asked. Not losing to bad teams also is a mark of a team that belongs in kind of that grouping of NCAA quality teams. And this is written for us by Tommy Birch, who is the Register Sports Enterprise and Features Reporter.
Turning now to Dear Abby. Wife finds it difficult to accept husband's past. Dear Abby, after 17 years of marriage, I learned to my dismay that when he was 22, my husband had a long-term relationship with a 16-year-old. He insisted she had lied about her age and told him she was 20. But even after finding out her true age, he went back to her. Her mother was okay with it, as well as other family members who all knew she was underage. It makes me sick to my stomach. They engaged in sexual activity when she was underage. They were even engaged until she allegedly cheated. I'm livid because he tried to say he told me she was underage, but he never did. I would never have dated or married someone who knowingly had sex with an underage individual. I've been questioning a lot about this marriage, but this sent me over the top. Am I overreacting because he was young and dumb and did something stupid and never did it again, as he puts it? Signed, Can't Get Over It. Dear Can't, the most important line in your letter, as far as I am concerned, is this one. I've been questioning a lot about this marriage. The first item on your agenda should be to make an appointment with a licensed marriage and family therapist so you and your husband can start working on what's wrong with your relationship. His feelings for that girl were sincere. He would have married her had she not cheated on him. If he has been a faithful and caring husband since your marriage, it's time to forgive him for his youthful indiscretion, which was encouraged by the girl's family. Dear Abby, my son and daughter-in-law are in their early 30s. They have a 5-year-old child who hasn't seen a doctor since infancy. They opted not to vaccinate. Although my husband and I do not agree with it, we keep our mouths shut. Our previous granddaughter has been sick with a severe cough and fever off and on for close to 2 months. Although they have health insurance, they refuse to take her to a doctor. They treat her with over-the-counter meds and holistic remedies. I finally told my daughter-in-law I felt it was negligence not to take the child to a pediatrician. The other grandmother feels the same way I do. Now I'm being canceled for finally expressing how I feel. I am disconsolate with the thought that they would actually do that to me. I did apologize for my choice of words and the way I said them. What else can I do to make things right again? My son is no help. He doesn't go against his wife for any reason. Signed, Heartbroken Nana in Florida. Dear Nana, if I read your letter correctly, you stated your grandchild has had no vaccinations. Nothing to prevent whooping cough, diphtheria, measles, chicken pox, or polio. To me, that describes gross negligence. Because your henpecked son refuses to step in, you may have to accept there is nothing you or the other grandmother can do to make things right again. But the two of you could contact Child Protective Services and ask if they agree what's happening is negligence. And you can contact Dear Abby at abby@www.dearabby.com.
For the last 90 minutes, your readers have been Patty Daniels and Pam Rhodes. It's been our pleasure to read for you. Now we'll take a short break to allow our next readers to get into place. And that brings us to the end of the Des Moines Register for today. I'm Patty Daniels, and my partner at the microphone has been Pam Rhodes. Earlier, you heard Bob DeHeck and Dennis May. You can listen to IRIS programs on any computer or smart device at any time at iowaradioreading.org. Support for today's readings comes from the Des Moines Register, Iowa Public Radio, Iowa PBS, and bensoundmusic.com. Thank you for listening to IRIS, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.